We will look at Kwantapura, probably 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. Then this afternoon, we will look at least once at the Syllabus of Errors. If you haven't got the text of the Syllabus of Errors, which was published together with Kwantapura by Pius IX, then ask Mrs. Merrin in the office, or maybe somebody could ask Mrs. Merrin in the office. She has a number of copies. Now, this we saw is the background. This is the last 700 years of history, pretty condensed. Then that is, on the right is the liberal way of looking at all of those years, and on the left is the Catholic way of looking at all of those years. The Catholic way of looking at it makes it clear that from a human point of view, it's one long decline. From God's point of view, it's always a launching ramp for heaven. However low the world sinks, the world was low at the time of Christ. It was raised by Christ to the heights of the Middle Ages, the spiritual heights of the Middle Ages. From the heights of the Middle Ages, it's gone down again. But whether the church was climbing, whether the church was at a height, whether the church is sinking, nothing stops souls from going to heaven. Imagine a submarine in the depths of the ocean. It can still launch Polaris missiles to the other side of the world. So the church, however much sunk beneath the waves, is still capable of sending souls to heaven. So the human view of things is not the same as the divine view of things. So it's not because we say these 700 years are, humanly speaking, one long decline, that we are therefore today, the Catholics are in despair or in disgust. Although they might well be, when they see how things really are and what a fall there has been, they might well be disgusted. We're into the 19th century, and in Kwantapura, we're well into the 19th century, 1864. Pius IX became Pope in 1846, just a year and a half or 2 years before another of the Freemasonic revolutions. The Freemasons achieved the enemies of the church, notably the Freemasons, achieved their first, actually, best called the Judeo-Masons. In other words, the conspiracy of Jews and Freemasons, which is what is really the enemy of the church. Not all Jews work with the Freemasons. Not all Freemasons work with the Jews. There are innocent and decent and very saintly Jews. There are innocent Freemasons who don't really know what Freemasonry is all about. But the world is being destroyed, the prime agents of Satan, for this decline, at any rate in recent times, and the prime agents of Satan for the destruction of Christian civilization are those Jews who work with the Masons and those Masons who work with the Jews, and the simple name for that is Judeo-Masonry, meaning the conjunction of Jews and Masons. You read Father Fay's excellent books and you can see he says that this decline is due to Satan, but Satan has two main human instruments. The first of those is Judaism and the second is Masonry. You may be a little surprised to hear that because, of course, today everybody says the Jews are victims, the Jews are innocent, the Jews are oppressed, the Jews are the most wonderful people on earth. That's not historically true. From a Catholic point of view, it's not historically true. And when you see things from a Catholic point of view, from a liberal point of view, that is absolutely true. The great heroes of all of this are the Jews. In this point of view, the heroes are the Jews. In which case, as you might expect, from this point of view, the Jews have been, ever since they crucified our Lord Jesus Christ, or caused the Romans to crucify our Lord Jesus Christ, they have been the principal villains, the principal enemies of the Catholic Church. So let's say Judeo-Masonry, or quite simply, Masonry. Masonry achieved its first great victory with the first French Revolution in 1789, which ran for a few years, and by the terror actually only came a few years later, 1793, when the French revolutionaries were shooting and guillotining anybody who got in their way. And there was a French revolutionary who said, "We would rather destroy half the population of France than change our ideas or renounce our ideals." That tells you that, like these revolutionaries, their ideas are more valuable than human beings. You may remember at the bottom of the diagonal, our idea, we must get rid of 9/10 of the world population. That's revolutionary talk. That's typical revolutionary talk. We would best, for the sake of the spotted owl now, it's not even now for the sake of civilization, it's for the sake of the spotted owl and the baby seal, we ought to get rid of 9/10 of the world's population. That's revolutionary talk. 1789, the first terrible revolution, Europe, followed by Napoleon, who consolidated the revolution. Finally, Europe, so to speak, got its act together and defeated Napoleon and shipped him off to the island of St. Helena, where he died, poisoned, apparently. They've examined traces of his body and they can find traces of arsenic, so he was quietly poisoned by the British, I think. I don't entirely blame them. Napoleon was not a good man. But Europe sort of got its act together again and sort of restored things like they were before the revolution, but it wasn't the same. It just wasn't the same. It couldn't be the same. And the result was that the Freemasons had their, like you may remember, the camel gets his nose under the tent, and when he gets his nose under the tent, it's simply a matter of time before the rest of him comes into the tent. The Freemasons had their nose well inside the Christian tent with the French Revolution, and therefore it was simply a matter of time before the next revolution came along in 1830, when the French monarchy that had been restored, the Bourbon monarchy, was kicked out in France, and replaced by the Orléans monarchy, Louis-Philippe Égalité, which was already a monarchy compromising with the revolution. The Bourbons were still sort of resisting the revolution. The Orléans compromised with the revolution. So you can see the old regime, the old way, the old Christian civilization is being steadily pushed out as the camel of Freemasonry pushes in. It's this way of thinking in the 19th century steadily, consistently, and logically giving way to that way of thinking. It's the continuing advance of human rights, the continuing dethroning of Christ. Therefore, a revolution in 1830, and in 1832, the Pope then, Gregory the 16th, writes an encyclical which some of you have seen in early years called Mirari Vos, 1832, Mirari Vos. And he bitterly condemns, he strongly condemns, in language just like you've got here in Quantacura, strong, strong language for these liberal, to condemn these liberal ideals. It's remarkable, you know, I mean, liberty of the press, what's wrong with that? Human rights, what's wrong with that? Democracy, what's wrong with that? Come on. These things aren't as bad. The popes yell. You can hear Pius the Tenth. I mean, popes don't yell, but by golly, they come, as close as they come to it, they yell here. They say, this is pernicious, this is wicked, this is deadly, this is death and damnation. I mean, we'll see this. The nefarious enterprises of wicked men who, like the raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own confusion and promising liberty, whereas their slaves corruption, have striven by their deceptive opinions and most pernicious writings to raise to the ground, that's to destroy, the very foundations of the Catholic religion and the civil society, to remove from among men all virtue and justice, to deprave persons, especially inexperienced youth, to lead it into the snares of error, and at length to tear it from the bosom of the Catholic Church. That's dramatic language. And that the Pope, Pope Pius IX, he's not saying, hey, these liberals are nice guys. You know, we can come to an understanding. They mean well. They're sincere. They've got ideals. They've got valuable ideals, which they really believe in. We can work along with that. No, the Pope doesn't say that at all. And this is a Catholic Pope. Who was actually up for canonization. Pius IX is up for canonization. His canonization is on the way. I think he's been declared venerable. It started. The first part. There's venerable and then blessed and then saint. I think he's declared venerable already.
I have heard he was declared blasphemous.
He was declared which?
I thought blasphemous.
I don't think so, yes. I don't think. I stand to be corrected. I think he's only servant of venerable or servant of God so far. I think it's only the first step. But in any case, there is definite question of his canonization. I don't see how the liberals in Rome today could possibly canonize him, because he stands for the exact opposite of everything they stand for, the liberals today in Rome. So I don't see how it's possible. But in any case, nevertheless, Providence has allowed his canonization to get underway. Quantacura is just like, then, the encyclical of Gregory XVI in 1832. And Gregory XVI came Because what happened in the early 1830s was that there was a French priest, a brilliant French priest called Félicité de Lamennais, Father Félicité de Lamennais. And de Lamennais, coming out of the revolution, coming out of the era of Napoleon, and coming out of the restoration of the Bourbon monarchy, supposedly like it was before the revolution, Lamennais, because the French Revolution was there, it had happened and things weren't the same. And Lamennais thought he had a brilliant idea. Hey, let's get the revolution and the church together. And how we'll do that is we'll say that Catholicism is the best thing for the people. Catholicism is the choice of the people. Catholicism is the best choice of the people. And so that way we will combine the church and democracy. We will have the church approved by the people. And that way we will combine the church and democracy. So all of the new ideas of the revolution and all of the old ideas of Catholicism, we will fit together. And so Félicité de Lamennais at that point in time was the launcher of what has been called ever since liberal Catholicism. In other words, the reconciling, the fitting together of those ideas and these ideas. Now you may say, if you listened to the talk last night, you may say, hey, that's impossible. These are exactly opposite. Well, they are exactly opposite. But because so many people believe in this, today, in the modern age, at any rate, here, and because this is so true, because of Jesus Christ, there have always been Catholics who wanted to put it together. And there have even been liberals who want to put it together. And so the Catholics and the Catholic liberals and the liberal Catholics want to sort of have the best of both worlds, and they want to try to fit it together. Well, the pioneer of that was Félicité de Lamennais. Lamennais launched these, as he thought, brilliant ideas. He certainly launched them in a brilliant way with some brilliant young friends. And then the only thing that they really needed, they launched this publication called L'Avenir in 1830, called The Future. And some of the very best and brightest young Catholic minds in France, and they were minds, were with Lamennais. But what they didn't have was the official approval of the church. So since there was question about that, and since some of the old fuddy-duddies were sort of fingering Lamennais and saying, hey, no, then Lamennais thought he would settle the question by going down to Rome and seeing the Pope and getting the Pope to agree to his brilliant ideas. So Lamennais went down to Rome and he saw Gregory the 16th, the old bachelor Pope in 1831, I think it was. Maybe early 1832, and he had an audience with the Pope, and the old Pope said, come in, young man, father. Father, how is your mother? Here's this young man burning with this brilliant crusading idea of how to save civilization. Father, how is your mother? He asked after Lamennais' mother. He said, oh, would you like a rosary? And the old man gave him a rosary. And then he sort of patted him on the head. All right, my boy, that's enough. Bye-bye, father, bye-bye. And so he shunted out Lamennais, and that was all that Félicité, Father de Lamennais, brilliant young savior of the church, savior of civilization, that's all that he could get out of the old fuddy-duddy, backwards dinosaur bachelor in Rome. So de Lamennais wasn't too pleased, but sure enough, a little later, in 1832, not an encyclical we're looking at this time, but Quantacour is quite like it. In 1832, finally Rome at last reacted and took the position that de Lamennais had wanted Rome to take, except that it wasn't the position Rome took position, but it wasn't the position that de Lamennais wanted, on the contrary. And the old man came out with this fulminating condemnation of these brilliant new reconciling ideas. That was one of the first and strongest, clearest, and simplest condemnations of any possibility of reconciling these ideas with these. There's no way liberalism and Catholicism can be reconciled. And if the Pope, Gregory the 16th, at that time was so strong, it's because he knew what a glossy package this represents. It's a very deceptive and glossy package. Liberty, sounds good. Rights of man, wow. Who could be against that? A crusade for man, wonderful. Democracy, the people, love of the people. Who could be against that? Okay. liberty, equality, fraternity. They're very attractive sounding ideals, and they very easily deceive people. And they've been deceiving people strongly for these last 100, 150, 200 years. Therefore, the new ideas are very appealing, they're very glossy, they're very slick, they're very dangerous. Because they're untrue. And that's why the Pope comes out, these popes, firstly Gregory the 16th and then Pius the 9th, actually before Gregory the 16th at the time of the French Revolution too. But Gregory the 16th was the first to condemn this attempt to combine the revolution and the church. At the time of the revolution itself, Pius the 6th and Pius the 7th both condemned the revolution, but that was clear. The revolution was slashing priests to pieces, slaughtering nuns, destroying churches. It's not very difficult to see that that's a bad thing. But what is difficult to see as a bad thing is the proposition to combine all the ideals of the new world together with all the ideals of the old world. It seems like a wonderful idea. And then you can have the best of the new world and the best of the old world, and you can fit it all together. You can have Christian democracy or democratic Christianity. What's wrong with that? Jesus loved the people. Democracy loves the people. Of course Jesus and democracy can get together. You can see it's the liberal ideals are very appealing. And in order to wake people up and make them realize just how dangerous they are, the Pope has got to yell. And he's got to say, look, this package that you're buying here is not what it looks. And it's not sweet and glossy. It's poisonous. And I tell you, our venerable brethren bishops, this is an encyclical letter, is a round letter to all of the bishops of the Catholic Church. And he says to the bishops, look, your excellencies, these ideas are poison. You've got to feed your sheep. This is poison pasture. Liberty of the press. Liberty of speech. Liberty of religion, liberty of conscience, liberty of these liberties are poison. Poison. And he yelled, they're poison. So, what then happened, despite the Pope's condemnation in 1832, still the Masons advanced. They went from revolution in 1830, things sort of stabilized in France in particular, they've stabilized in Austria with the great Prince Metternich, Prince von Metternich. But by 1848, with the new ideas circulating and with the Masons hard at work, they generated another revolution. This revolution in 1848 was 2 years after Pope Pius IX had become Pope. When Pope Pius IX became Pope in 1846, he was relatively young. Count from Mastroietti, I think his name was. And he was relatively young. When he became Pope, the papacy still had the pontifical states, which is a sort of a stretch across the middle of Italy, which was under the political control, not only under the religious control, but also under the political control of Rome. They were called the pontifical states because the Pope was actually politically king of this. Of course, the Pope had somebody else to administer it, but this political control of the center of Italy meant that it guaranteed the Pope's freedom. He wasn't going to have the robbers and the bandits and the police breaking into the Vatican apartments because he was in control of this whole part of Italy. It goes a long way back in history that he was in control. But now, when he became Pope, the revolution, the Masons and the revolutionaries had been working up agitation inside the pontifical states, and the prisons of the pontifical states were full of a bunch of liberal conspirators and revolutionaries and seditionists. And so, when Pope Pius IX became Pope, as a gesture of goodwill, he released some of them from prison. And he gave the liberals liberty to publish some of their newspapers. I mean, when he became Pope, he made a gesture of goodwill in the direction of the liberals. What he hadn't realized, of course, was the liberals immediately turned round and used his gesture of goodwill in order to stir up even more agitation and revolution. Because that's the way they are. I mean, if it's a duck, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. If they're revolutionaries, they're going to walk and quack like a revolution, they're going to stir up revolution. So they immediately stirred up even more revolution, not less, but more, in the pontifical states. 1848, about a year and a half or so after he became Pope, 1848, the Masons brought about the next big revolution, and in many different European countries, in France, in Berlin, I think, in Italy, all over. 1848, another Masonic revolution. And in Rome, it was particularly dangerous. The crowds got out of control, and the Pope, Pope Pius IX himself, was obliged to disguise himself as a priest and get out of the back of the Vatican into a waiting carriage and escape from Rome down to Gaeta, down to the south, which is down here in near Naples. He was obliged to run for his life in 1848, and he had to stay away from Rome for 18 months until at last order was restored in Rome, because the revolutionaries ran wild in Rome. They had for a while a revolutionary government running Rome. It was chaos. Finally, order was restored, and at last the Pope could come back to Rome. But when the Pope came back to Rome in 1848, he had learned his lesson. There would be no more pussyfooting with the liberals or with the revolutionaries. The Pope had learned the hard way just what these liberals are like. They talk nice, they talk sweet, they talk like doves, but they act like hawks. They have a sweet line of talk, but their hands are dripping with blood. And you've got a classic example, I've said to you, in these abortionists. They pretend to be nice to everybody, tolerant to everybody, but don't get in their way, especially if you're a little innocent child in your mother's womb. Because if you get in the way of what they want and their pleasure, they will rip you out and slaughter you. That's the way liberals are. Therefore, Pius IX learned it, and so when he came back as Pope, from then on he was very clear, very, very clear about what it would take to defend the church. He, Pius IX, was the longest reigning church pope in all church history. He was pope from 1848 to 1846 to 1878, 32 years. He was the longest reigning pope in all history. And for all of those 30 years, when he came back to Rome, he was a valiant, he came back to Rome 1850. From 1850 to 1878, for 28 years, he was a strong and valiant and very clear-minded pope. 1850, 1878, 1864 is exactly halfway through those 28 years. And he had been thinking, mulling over. As he tells us in the beginning of Quanta Cura, I've already been talked and issued the condemnation of the modern era several times, but I need to do it once more, clearly and in one package, so to speak. And this is the famous Quanta Cura, which was published together with the even more famous Syllabus of Errors, which we'll look at later today. And these two documents, Quanta Cura and the Syllabus of Errors, absolutely condemn this whole package, the false principles, the complete package, especially the false principles upon which this package rests. The Pope says this is wrong. It's not only wrong, it's very dangerous, it's slick, it's glamorous, it's glossy, but it's poison. It is absolute poison. The modern world didn't like Quanta Cura, and it didn't like the Syllabus of Errors. And nowhere no government liked it. And all of the governments, the various European governments, they all began squirming. Prime Minister Gladstone in England, he also squirmed. The Pope had very little support in the middle of the 19th century for this, for what he said here. Because the 19th century was all going the wrong way, and here was the Vicar of Christ telling them, you're going the wrong way, you are wrong. Your whole modern shebang is wrong. It's sick, it's crazy, it's wrong. It's going to produce the 20th century. It's going to produce death and destruction. The Pope was absolutely right, but that didn't mean that people paid any attention. Some people paid attention, but the great mass of people didn't, which is why the 19th century rolled on into the 20th century, opening up with the wonderful First World War. So great. Never before has any war succeeded in killing 14.5 million people. Isn't that wonderful? And then the Second World War, 66 million people. I mean, at that rate, we could get rid of the whole human race. Think! Gee whiz. That's the 20th century. The Pope said, this is what's going to happen. People listen. Because they're sold on this package. They love the glossy package. Right, let's have a look at Quanta Cura then. Especially the main principles which Pius IX is condemning. To our venerable brethren. So those are all of the bishops. With how great care. That, of course, is the Latin quanta cura. With how great care. It's the ablative feminine singular. An encyclical is always named after the first two Latin words in the text. And the popes always write the encyclical with care so that the first word or first two words announce the sort of, kind of announce the theme of the encyclical. So what Pius IX is saying is, the modern world is driving us crazy. With how much anxiety, so to speak. And pastoral bishops, the Roman pontiffs, fulfilling the duty in office committed to them by Christ of feeding the lambs and the sheep, have never ceased carefully to nourish the Lord's whole flock with words of faith and with sanitary doctrine to guard it from poison pastures. Now, all of that is thoroughly known to you, especially to you, my dear bishops. And so, our predecessors, the popes that went in before us, anxious for the salvation of souls, have been very careful to condemn all of these horrible errors in order to protect Catholic doctrine, the purity of morals, and the salvation of men. Frequently excited, the previous popes have sought to unveil, to discover, to show them for what they really are, because these errors are very glossy. Freedom of speech is very attractive. Sounds good. Freedom of speech. It's very flattering. We're all noble. Just allow everybody to say what he thinks and the truth will prevail. Because you're all good guys. You're all intelligent and you're all good. Says Thomas Jefferson. And so look, just let's have a free marketplace of ideas and the truth will prevail. Oh yeah, that's me all right. Oh yeah. And then along comes the Catholic Church and says, no way, Jose. No freedom because you've all got original sin, and if there's a free marketplace of ideas, it's lies that are going to prevail. Who does he think he is? See? The Catholic Church humbles us by telling us that we've all got original sin and we can't afford a free marketplace of ideas. I don't like to hear that. And then along comes Thomas Jefferson and says, oh, you're great guys, of course the truth will prevail, it's just the free... Oh, I like to hear that. See the difference? The doctrine of original sin humbles us and it excludes freedom of speech. The modern doctrine builds us up, says you haven't got original sin, you're the Immaculate Conception, we're all of us conceived immaculate. And therefore, of course, freedom of speech and all of these freedoms... And if there's one doctrine that you want to get clear that underlies all of these errors, it's the doctrine of original sin. I mean, that underlies all these errors in the sense that it's original sin which underlies all of these errors. It's original sin which is at the root of these errors. And it's the denial of original sin which is which gives rise to all of these false liberties. Because the liberals treat men as though they're angels, which of course we aren't. We are not angels. If we were angels, then of course we could have freedom of speech. But we're not, and therefore we can't. So, these modern errors, they're glossy and they're attractive, they're dressed up in very good dress, and therefore they need to be unveiled. The covering needs to be stripped off these glossy errors, and they need to be shown for what they are. Because these errors have frequently excited violent tempests, they've miserably afflicted church and state. And therefore, our predecessors have resisted the wicked enterprises of these wicked men, like raging waves of the sea. It's extraordinary language. Very strong language. How can he say such things? I mean, these are the great ideals of the American democracy. And here's the Pope tearing them to pieces. You've got to take your pick. It's either Jeffersonian democracy or Catholicism, but it can't be both. Not that all is wrong in Jeffersonian democracy. But there's a lot that's wrong. I tell you, the errors originally came from John Locke, was the English philosopher that's behind all of those errors. But you have to take your pick. This is the real Catholicism, not the Vatican II version. And there's no compromise between the real Catholicism and Jeffersonian democracy. There's no compromise. Now, scarcely had we been elevated to the chair of Peter, paragraph 2, when a truly awful storm, excited by so many evil opinions, grievous calamities, never sufficiently deplored, overspread the Christian people. And then we raised our voice. So, again, that, of course, is the storm of 1848. That's the revolution of 1848, which made him run from Rome, run for his life. And he condemned it. We condemned the chief errors of this most unhappy age. This most unhappy age. The Pope, the Vicar of Christ, saying the 19th century was not a good time. All of the modern world says the 19th century was the next best thing to the 20th century. I mean, think, in the 20th century, we've got computers. I mean, think, we've got 747s. We've got dentist chairs. I mean, what features of civilization can possibly compare with computers, dentistry, and 747s? I mean, these things are wonderful. And our stupid ancestors never had any such thing. We're so much better than they ever were. Well, that's not what the Pope says. The Pope says this is a most unhappy age. If you think the Pope's wrong, then you're not going to understand Catholicism. You're not going to understand the real Catholicism. You're almost certainly a liberal Catholic. If you think the Pope's got it wrong, then you're a liberal Catholic. I hope you save yourself. But it's very doubtful. Then, we condemn the chief errors of this most unhappy age. We excited your admirable vigilance. We roused you up to watch out, you bishops, and guard the flock and stop them walking into poison pastures. We again admonished and exhorted all sons of the Catholic Church. They should abhor and flee from the contagion of so dire a pestilence. Listen to his language. The Pope is yelling. Yelling. Liberty of speech. Liberty, equality, fraternity. The Pope yells. This is poison. But today, everybody just automatically believes it. Poof. No wonder the modern world's in a mess. The Pope is saying that the Pope's announcing well over 100 years ago, all of the ideas on which the modern world is built are false. Not only is it false, they're a dire pestilence. They're a plague. They're like AIDS. The Archbishop of Lefebvre used to compare Vatican II to AIDS inside the church. Vatican II dismantled the church's defense mechanism, dismantled the immune mechanism of the church. And so all diseases just now kill Catholics, because the church has no more defense system left. Vatican II was like AIDS. A pestilence, a plague. AIDS is a plague, or it meant to be. We condemn the monstrous portents of opinion, bringing the greatest loss of souls and detriment to society, which are grievously opposed not only to the Catholic Church and the Catholic doctrine, but also to the eternal natural law. So the new doctrines are opposed to supernatural law of the church, and they're opposed to natural law, which is engraved on men's hearts. Freedom of speech is against the natural law, says the Holy Father. What? Freedom of speech, freedom of religion is against the natural law. What? Freedom of speech, freedom of religion are against the natural law. Huh? Although we have not omitted often to prescribe and condemn the chief errors of this kind, yet the defense of the church requires us to exterminate it again, to root out these evil errors springing forth from the said errors as a fountain. These false and perverse opinions are the more to be detested because they chiefly tend to getting rid of the Catholic Church, getting the Catholic Church out of the way, removing the Catholic Church. And of course the triumph of this was Vatican II, because that finally got rid of the Church as an obstacle to the glorious advance of liberalism. The salutary influence be impeded and removed, which the Catholic Church, as Christ commanded, should freely exercise to the end of the world, not only over individuals, but also over nations, notice. Not only over individuals, but also over nations, peoples and their sovereign princes. In other words, it's not, the Catholic Church does not accept that religion is just an individual affair and the federal government has the right to be independent of religion. No, the federal government must be under Jesus Christ the King just as much as the individuals must be under Jesus Christ the King. That is Catholic doctrine. That's the real McCoy. And if ever somebody says to you, ah, the church, that's just for the individuals, but the nations need to be independent because we've got so many different religions, sorry, wrong. You're building stairs out of sand. If you may have nothing else than sand with which to build those stairs, but then those stairs are not going to work. Take away that mutual fellowship and concord accounts between church and state. See, the liberal doctrine is separation of church and state. The Catholic doctrine is to unite the Catholic Church and the state. That the Catholic Church and the state work together. They don't interfere with one another's affairs. You have the statesman to run the state and you have the churchman to run the church. The churchmen are not meant to run the state and the state is not meant to run the church, but the two are meant to work together. And the state is meant to obey the Ten Commandments, and if the state disobeys the Ten Commandments, then the church has got the duty to get the Ten Commandments obeyed. Then the church has the duty to interfere in state affairs to make sure that God's will is obeyed. Therefore, you well know, very reverend, this time men are found, not a few, who applying to civil society, and we start with a list of particular errors. Note them one after another. Here's the first coming up. There are about perhaps 16 of them. There may be a few more, but at least 16 of these errors. Here's the first one. The best constitution of public society and civil progress altogether require that human society be conducted and governed without regard being had to religion any more than if it did not exist. In other words, a country is best run without any regard to religion. The First Amendment. There's going to be no official religion in this federal government. This federal government is going to give equal rights and equal recognition to all religions. Right? Now, you may say, but that's not to condemn religion. If you give equal rights and respect to all religions, you're not condemning religion. Now, stop and think. The Christian religions in your new nation say Jesus Christ is God. The non-Christian religions say Jesus Christ is not God. Your federal government says, your federal government, as federal government says, the Christian religions deserve just as much and just as little respect, or just as much respect, as the non-Christian religions. The non-Christian religions deserve just as much respect as the Christian religions. There's going to be no official religion in the federal government. Therefore, as far as the federal government is concerned, all religions are equal. Now, all religions are equal. Therefore, Jesus Christ is God is just as respectable as saying Jesus Christ isn't God. In that case, what is the federal government implicitly saying? Explicitly, it's saying all religions are on an equal footing as far as we're concerned. Implicitly, it's saying it doesn't really matter to our country whether Jesus Christ is God or isn't God. If it did matter, we would take sides. If we thought that Jesus Christ is God, it matters, we would take side with the Christian religion. If we thought Jesus Christ isn't God matters, we would take side with the non-Christian religions. We're not taking sides. Therefore, it doesn't matter whether Jesus Christ is God or isn't, as far as the federal government is concerned. As far as the federal government is concerned, the divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ doesn't matter. The non-divinity doesn't matter. Religion doesn't matter. What people think in their religions doesn't matter as far as we're concerned. And therefore the federal government is saying religion doesn't matter. This is what so many people can't understand. So many decent Americans say, but the founding fathers never meant to scorn religion. The founding fathers meant to protect all religions equally. Hey, protecting all religions equally means protecting contradiction. The religions all contradict one another. For instance, over whether Jesus Christ is God or not, whether the Holy Eucharist is the real presence or not. If you give equal honor to all of the religions, you might just as well give no honor to any of them. And you are also undermining ideas and you're undermining thinking, you're undermining the mind, And that's why sentiment takes over, and why so many Americans in this country, liberals anywhere, are sentimental. Because they have unhooked their mind. They say the things of the mind don't matter. Ideas don't matter. All that matters is facts. Give me facts. Ideas, religious ideas, all of that, just unimportant. Right? Now, I want nitty-gritty facts. Let's get to the bottom line. Money. Money. That's what matters. Money I can handle, I can count it, I can... That's action. The ideas, Sunday morning, my granny goes to that church, your granny goes to that church. It makes them all feel good. You know, I mean, that's Sunday morning, but that's got nothing to do with Monday to Saturday, or Sunday, even Sunday afternoon. It's right there. It's right there in the First Amendment. The First Amendment. The Founding Fathers may well have meant the First Amendment in the best possible way. Namely, as a means of enabling the nation to get together from one nation to get together from a whole lot of very different people and different religions. A means of getting over the religious wars. We've got over the religious wars. We are into a new and better system. Well, there's a terrible price to be paid. You may build stairs out of sand, but they're not going to work. It won't hold together. And what held the United States together was, firstly, as a good dose of Protestant religion, belief in God, and a belief in the Ten Commandments, and then towards the end of the 19th century, quite a significant shot of Catholic immigrants who brought Catholic ideas with them. These religious ideas are what sustained the United States. But the liberalism in the Constitution works to dissolve either that old-fashioned Protestantism or the Catholicism, and the Constitution therefore works for the dissolution of the United States, which is, of course, what's now happening. I speak of the United States. I've been speaking of the French, what was going on in France. England, again, is different. If I was in England, we'd be talking about the English version of all of these errors. If I was in France, we'd be talking about, if you were French and I was in France, we'd be talking about the French version of all these errors. We wouldn't be troubling with the American version. You and I are in the United States, and most of you are Americans, therefore, hey, this is what we know of and where we see these same errors in action. The Pope is not talking about England, France, or Germany, or the United States. He's talking generally because the ideas are general. Satan is everywhere, Jesus Christ is everywhere, it's not a question of the nation. But the problem with the United States is that the United States was founded on these errors. It was built on these errors. That's what's so difficult here. This is the first error. The best constitution of public society and civil progress want and require that society be conducted and governed without any regard to religion. Forget about religion. And say that the First Amendment doesn't look like that, but the First Amendment is in fact that. It's regrettable, but that's just the truth of the matter. Against the doctrine of Scripture, Church, and Holy Fathers, these delinquents do not hesitate to assert, quote, "The best condition of civil society is that in which no duty is recognized as attached to the civil power of restraining by enacted penalties offenders against the Catholic religion, except so far as public peace may require." In other words, it's a similar error. No government should protect Catholicism. No government should protect Catholicism. Now that's definitely the First Amendment, obviously the First Amendment. The First Amendment says we mustn't protect Catholicism, we mustn't protect Protestantism, we mustn't protect Hinduism, we mustn't protect any religion. But that includes, we must know, says the Pope, the duty of a government, of any society, is to protect Catholicism. Because every country, every government, every human being comes from God. God took flesh in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ founded the Catholic religion. The Catholic religion is the only religion that comes from God. And these men, created by that one God, have a bounden duty in running a state, as far as possible, as far as practical, to protect the one true religion in that state. Because when those rulers go in front of their maker, they will answer for how they ruled that country, and whether they ruled it in such a way as to help or to hinder souls being saved and going to heaven for eternity. Every government has a duty to protect Catholicism, including Her Majesty's government in London. Uh, Her Majesty's government in London doesn't think any such thing. Her Majesty's government in London thinks that the British Empire is the bee's knees and the cat's whiskers. We are the tops. We don't need anybody to tell us what to do. We English, we know how to do things. We are superior. We are superior beings. That's what the English think. And we don't need even God to tell us how to do things. Therefore, we don't need to run affairs in England in such a way as to protect Catholicism. In fact, we got rid of Catholicism. We were so smart that we got rid of it back in the 16th century. And we don't need it to come back ever since then. We have got a superior way of doing things to Catholicism. So you try telling Her Majesty's government that it ought to run things, that it ought to protect Catholicism. Very few Englishmen will believe that. But that's the Catholic truth. Very few Englishmen are Catholic. And Vatican II teaches the exact opposite of what Pius IX here says. Vatican II teaches that it's best if a government doesn't protect Catholicism. Teaches it. Vatican II goes dead against, exactly against what Pius IX said here. Vatican II was dismantling Catholicism. It was dismantling the Catholic Church. Vatican II was getting out of step with the Catholic Church and into step with liberalism. That was it. So that's the secondary. The language is slightly complicated, but the meaning is the best way to run a society is for the government not to protect Catholicism. The Pope says that is an error. It's a pernicious, dire, pestilential error. Pernicious, dire, pestilential, and poisonous error. No wonder they changed the Catholic Church, you'd have to admit. The Catholic Church really was out of date. I mean, the Catholic Church really needed to get with it. So we had Vatican II, so that the Catholic Church would at last step out of all of this old-fashioned nonsense. You mean this nonsense went on for another 100 years, 1864, all the way through to 1964? Yes, it did. Well, no wonder they got rid of it in 1964. I mean, really. Third error. From this totally false idea of social government, from this totally false idea of the right way to govern a society, meaning the government should not protect Catholicism, from this totally false idea, they do not fear to foster the erroneous opinion, most fatal in its effects, on the Catholic Church and on the salvation of souls, called by our predecessor Gregory XVI an insanity. Okay, number three coming up. Wait for it. Liberty of conscience and worship is each man's personal right, which ought to be legally proclaimed and asserted in every rightly constituted society. That's number three. In other words, freedom of conscience. That's a sacred principle for the liberals. A sacred principle for Jefferson, Washington, Madison, you name them. A sacred principle for, please, English statesmen going a long way further back, please. And here the Pope says it's wrong. It's not only wrong, it's insanity. Liberty of conscience is insanity. Do you realize how off track people are relating to the old Catholic religion to contrast it with the religion of Vatican II? Can you understand why the American Catholic bishops, when this came out, what do you think their reaction was? Yes.
They kind of stuck it under the rug.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
They stuck it under the rug. They believe that was referred to the old countries of Europe.
That's
and
it.
Liberals in Europe, because they were more liberal and we were more conservative.
There you are. That's right. That's it. Oh, those Europeans, oh, those Frenchmen, they're always arguing, they all get worked up about ideas. I mean, whoever got worked up about ideas? What sane, practical man ever got worked up about ideas? Those French, oh, forget it. We Americans, you know, that's the attitude. It's been the attitude ever since. And there's a lot to be said about that. There's much to be said about it. But the principles remain. The principles are universal. The principles are absolutely universal, and therefore it applies just as much to the United States as anywhere else. But Americans of goodwill are persuaded that all decent men will go on being decent. And decent men won't misuse these principles. And therefore the principles are not bad because decent men won't misuse them. But the problem is that decent men won't go on being decent just by themselves. Decent men, in order to be decent, need strong support and good ideas. Otherwise their decency will disappear. And therefore you can't rely on decency to make a decent use of bad principles. And therefore the principles are bad. And you can't, and therefore if Americans, for instance, rely upon men of good sense not taking liberty to extremes, it just doesn't work, because you can see today all of those liberties being taken to wild extremes. It's now liberty of abortion. It's the sacred right, the human right, the woman's right over her own body, the sacred right of abortion. So, third, liberty of conscience and worship is each man's personal right. No, it isn't. We do not have a right not to be Roman Catholic. Not even a Hindu, not even a Buddhist, not even a Jew, not even a communist, not even an atheist. Nobody has the right not to be Roman Catholic. That's what the Pope says. That's the old-fashioned Catholicism. That's why people, Catholics, used to be martyrs. In the old days, you know, I mean, these 13, 14-year-old girls, virgins, used to come in front of the Roman Emperor. And the Roman Emperor would say, "My dear child, if you don't just drop a few grains of incense to the emperor, I'm going to rack you, I'm going to torture you, I'm going to burn you, I'm going to flay you. If you do, I will marry you to the most handsome young man in Rome. You will have a wonderful estate." And these 13-year-old girls said, "Your Majesty, I'm sorry, I can't. I can't. You have a duty to worship this man that I worship, this Jesus Christ that I worship. He is God, and those that you worship are devils." "What, my child? Your gods and your emperors, that emperor worship is devil worship because it's idolatry." "Wow!" And they flayed and burned and racked and tortured and threw to the beasts these girls. They're now in the missal. They're in the breviary. They died at the age of 30 and went straight to heaven. Today, imagine the emperor coming up to a little liberal girl of 13. "Now, my child, what do you think of my religion?" Oh, your majesty, you have a right of conscience, and you have a right to think what you like and to believe what you like, and I have a right to believe what I like. So you think my religion is really right? I think you have a complete right to it, your majesty." "That's what I wanted to hear." "Well, now, you're not going to go and tell anybody that everybody else has to be Catholic, are you?" "No, no, no, your majesty. I think Catholicism is best for me, but I would never say that it had to be for anybody else." "All right, my dear little child. Now, you go home and you worship on Sunday morning, but don't you interfere with the Roman Empire." Your majesty, I will never interfere with anything in the Holy Roman Empire." See the difference? Those girls would never have been martyrs. Liberal Catholicism will never make martyrs. The only Catholicism that will make martyrs is the Catholicism that says everybody's got to be Catholic, otherwise they're going to hell. Otherwise they are offending God, they're worshipping devils, they're committing idolatry, they're breaking the first commandment, they're going to go to hell. Those will become martyrs. The religion of the missal on the altar, the religion of the breviary, the religion of martyrs is a religion in which the 13-year-old girls say everybody's got to be Catholic, otherwise they're going to go to hell. That's not today's religion. Today's religion, today, Catholics today, "Oh, you take what religion you like." The Holy Father goes all over the world saying to everybody, "You follow what religion you like." Catholicism is a little bit nicer than the others, but not much. As long as your religion makes you a nice guy and he makes his a nice guy, we can all understand and hold hands and have a nice party together. And then we will have world peace. That's what the Holy Father himself is saying. That's not Catholicism. It's got nothing to do with it. It's got nothing to do with Catholicism. The poor man, he's way off track. He's completely forgotten. Actually, he probably knows this, but he thinks that his ideas are the continuation of this. They're the exact opposite of this, but he thinks that they're the continuation because his mind is made of rubber. So 2 and 2 is 4 one moment, it's 5 the next. And then it's 16. And then it's 300,000 because it's much more creative. For 2 and 2 to be 300,000, I mean, that's novel. Nobody's ever thought of that before. It's new. It's exciting. It's creative. It's mind enriching to think that, you know, 2 and 2, I mean, it's very narrow minded. 2 and 2 are 4. Come on, that's narrow minded. I mean, let's be broad minded, you know. So that's how these popes think both that this is true. If you ask John Paul II, is this true? He'd say, of course it's true. But of course it's also true that the other religions are wonderful. Of course it's true that Catholicism is wonderful. But it's also true that he refuses to admit that there's any contradiction. That their minds are just completely at sea. Let's have a look at just the fourth and then we will break. Liberty of conscience and worship is each man's personal right, which ought to be legally proclaimed and asserted in every rightly constituted society. In other words, the government must protect liberty of conscience. That's insanity, says the Pope. Insanity. The government must protect the right of every man to follow the religion of his own choice is insanity. D, the fourth error. A right resides in the citizens to an absolute liberty which should be restrained by no authority, ecclesiastical or civil, whereby they may be able openly and publicly to manifest and declare any of their ideas whatever, either by word of mouth, by the press, or in any other way. That, of course, is liberty of the press. Liberty of speech and liberty of press, of the press. And the Pope says it's crazy. He calls that, it also comes under insanity. He goes on, while they rashly affirm that every man ought to have liberty of speech and liberty of the press, they do not think and consider, they are preaching, in fact, liberty of perdition. Perdition, ruination, damnation. Liberty of the press, says the Holy Father, Pope Pius IX, liberty of the press means liberty of damnation. Try telling that to people today. How many people do you think could possibly accept or understand that liberty of the press means liberty of damnation? Can you see how directly contradictory these two things are? The other day, a liberal said to me, I don't agree with your ideas. And you know, I thought that was a great step forward. Why was it a great step forward for a liberal to say to me, I don't agree with your ideas? At least the liberal was at last recognizing there is contradiction. It was the first step to mental sanity. I don't know whether she'll take the second step, but she at least took the first step. Up till then, she undoubtedly thought, oh, we all agree, you know, everybody thinks exactly the same when we put it in slightly different words. You think 2 and 2 is 4, I think that 2 and 2 are 5, but we really think 2 and 2 are exactly the same. There's no real difference between 4 and 5. At last, she at least recognizes there's a difference between 4 and 5. It's a first step forward. These ideas violently and directly contradict what most people today take absolutely for granted.